delighted today to have two fantastic guests. Laura Kirk-Smith is the Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee. And with her, we have Abdul Amin. He's a PhD student and actually was a refugee client of the International Rescue Committee. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Okay then, Laura, to kick us off with a starter for 10 that I very much hope you can answer. What is the International Rescue Committee?
So the International Rescue Committee was set up in 1933 at the call of Albert Einstein. So we are celebrating our 90th birthday, as it were, this year. We work in 40 different countries worldwide. We're a humanitarian agency and we work with people who have been displaced by conflict and crisis or are caught up in conflict and crisis. And we work with our clients, our refugee clients, to help them to survive and to recover and to go on to rebuild their lives. We work with our refugee clients across five different outcome areas, the first of which is health, the second of which is safety, the third of which is economic well-being and empowerment, the fourth of which is education, and the fifth of which is power. And as well as being present in some of the toughest crises in the world, from Syria to Afghanistan to Yemen to Ukraine. In the last year, we've scaled up our programmes dramatically in Ukraine. We also work here in the UK, and we talk about working across the arc of crisis. So we will work with people when they are first displaced by a conflict or crisis, but we will also support them on their journeys if they do flee as refugees, and then we will support them as they resettle and integrate and build new lives in places like the UK if they choose to do so. So here in the UK we run programmes to support the integration of our refugee clients like Abdul, who I have with me today. And we offer a cultural orientation programme. We support with our refugee clients getting into the workplace. So there's a job readiness programme that we run. And there are other component parts of what we do. So we have a peer mentoring programme, a leadership training programme, and so on. But ultimately, we're here to serve our refugee clients across the world and to help them to survive and to recover and to rebuild their lives.
You've actually got quite a significant presence here in the UK, haven't you?
We have about 250 staff based here in the UK. Some of them are here delivering our programmes with refugees in the UK, but many more of them actually are there to support our overseas work. So we have people who will advocate to the government on behalf of our clients across the world, raise awareness of what's happening, raise really vital funds for them. So it's a mix of supporting our international programmes and then directly supporting our clients here.
Okay. And in those international programs, one of the things you try and do is develop peaceful solutions to sort of complicated developments and humanitarian challenges. I don't know, can either of you just sort of outline briefly how you go about that? That's quite a task you've set yourself.
I'll start and then I can pass over to Abdul as well to talk about his experience of that. But we are there first and foremost to meet humanitarian needs as we find them. We will always enter a country and start with a needs assessment. So we'll try and get a good feel for what other organisations are doing, if they're there already, what the government is or isn't doing. And we will build a humanitarian response programme around that initial needs assessment. So in health is the biggest sector of our work. So often we will go in and be providing immediate emergency health services, sometimes then staying and going on to build clinics and the kind of ongoing health infrastructure. But in other responses, it may be other areas of work that we lead on. In most humanitarian contexts, the UN, the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, will set up a sort of coordination and response mechanism. So we, alongside other NGOs, will know our place within that and the sort of aspects of the response that we're leading on. A couple of things that are common across all of our responses, though, it tends to be women and girls who are most dramatically affected by humanitarian crisis. Often they suffer worst in the first instance, and then the forces are sort of working against them in terms of rebuilding their lives onwards. So we will tend to really lean into working with women and girls. And then, of course, like all other humanitarian agencies, we are very respectful of the fact that there are the places where we go, and I mean, Ukraine is a good example of this. There are often very well-established civil society networks. There are sometimes local humanitarian response agencies who are there. They know better than we do as an international NGO what the needs are. So Ukraine is a great example where the response has really been led by our local partners, by these fantastic Ukrainian NGOs that were there before the war started, that have had to scale up their own responses in unimaginable ways, and we can support them with funding, we can support them with strengthening certain aspects of their work that they're not used to having to do, but really it's for those partners to be saying, this is what the gap is, this is where the needs are, and we'll shape our response accordingly. And the other factor I think we're seeing increasingly common across all of our responses is this emphasis on cash programming. So 10, 20 years ago, the tendency for a humanitarian agency like ours would have been to say, right, we're going to do health, we're going to give you medicines, we're going to give you, we're going to build a clinic that looks like this. And that's not necessarily the right way to go about things. It's our clients who know what their needs are in any given moment. And if what we do is provide them with the cash that empowers them to make the choices that they need to make, we see that the impact of our interventions is much more successful. And I visited our programs in Poland. We're working with Ukrainian refugees in Poland, and cash assistance has been the focus of our work there. You meet these incredible women and you ask them how they've been able to benefit from the cash assistance. And there was one woman who told me about her son who had chicken pox at the point at which they were forced to flee their home in Ukraine. And he just desperately needed some medicine for his chicken pox. He was really struggling with it. And that's what she spent the first tranche of her cash assistance on. Now, we could never have designed a program about chickenpox medication in Poland. But if you give the cash, it empowers the clients to make the choices that they need to make to get by in that awful situation they find themselves in. I don't know if Abdul wants to say more.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think, as Laura mentioned, it's very important to think about humanitarian assistance, not as humanitarian assistance per se, but to think about it from a kind of development perspective as well, in response to health sector giving cash for work in some other models that IRC is effectively applying these days. At least I'm talking from the context of Afghanistan, where IRC has, I think, an extravagant presence these days with thousands of employees that is reaching out to the most remote areas of the country that is less accessible with very poor infrastructure and so many other issues, but they're trying to reach out to those. So I look at it from that humanitarian development perspective, because I think this is, if you look at the problem of migrations, if you look at the problem of refugee crisis, I think it's very important to look at it from the long-term solutions, and merely a humanitarian aid or response in the short term will feed the stomachs of people, but it's not healing their long-term wounds and traumas. And I think it's very important to look at it from that humanitarian development nexus. And that, of course, requires, as Laura also alluded to, a very collaborated and integrated response. By bringing all the, not only humanitarian actors that is often coordinated by OCHA, but also development actors such as UNDP and other actors in the country to work together and to seek long-term solution to the migration issues.
Okay, that's true. I mean, the two things that really strike me about your answers, I suppose, is one, the empowerment of local accents. So I get the impression you don't just turn up with loads of Brits wanting to do good in a place, but it's about empowering locals. But the second is the sort of interconnectedness of everything, which I don't know if you agree with me. I sort of sense that we've sort of lost this from view a bit, that actually what we do internationally and what we don't do internationally has implications about what we end up doing here when we're faced with refugee crisis. Does it frustrate you sometimes that those two debates just seem, at least in my book, they just seem utterly separate from each other? We have a debate about foreign policy or development aid, And we have a separate debate about sort of refugees and immigration policy. And is there a way of linking them more effectively in our politics?
Absolutely. I think, so we have this debate about the illegal migration bill, about small boats. If you look at who's on their boats, who's on those boats, the statistics for last year show that half of them came from just five countries, which were Afghanistan, Syria, Eritrea, Sudan, and Iran. Those are people who are fleeing very desperate situations of crisis and persecution. And in fact, the government's own statistics show that for last year, three quarters of them went on to be granted refugee status. Their asylum claims were recognised to be legitimate claims, and they were given leave to remain here in the UK. So these are people who are fleeing exactly the type of crises that we're talking about when we talk about the humanitarian and the development work that we do. The government's response has to be, yes, partly to look at what's happening in the UK and what's happening on our borders, but the other half of it has to be to look at what's happening elsewhere in the world and to make choices about the role that Britain wants to play in solving those global humanitarian challenges. The humanitarian needs continue to grow. So if you look at the global statistics, this year there were 340 million people who were in need of humanitarian assistance worldwide, and there were 100 million people who went on to flee their homes, some of them just within their own country, but some across borders. This is the context. These are the trends that are driving the displacement that we see, and that's causing people to get into small boats and to risk their lives to come to the UK. And absolutely, thinking about that global context has to be part of the government's response. And you know, we have an ongoing engagement with the government about how they choose to allocate their overseas development budget. Our point is always that they should be looking to spend at least 50% of that budget in the fragile and conflict affected states, where we see conflict and climate change and economic crisis coming together and driving displacement. The aid budget has been cut, so there's a lot less of it to use, but actually, if it has been cut, then there's an opportunity to try and target it in a more impactful way, and doing that in fragile and conflict affected states is one way of ensuring that it does achieve maximum impact, and that would also bring benefit as it were, in terms of removing the or not removing, but at least reducing the reasons that people have to flee their homes.
Is there anything you want to add to that, Abdul?
I think I agree with what Laura said. It's very important to think about the response, both from domestic and from international perspective. And I think the international aspect is important, because this is looking at the conditions that are causing, in the root causes that are causing crises. Yeah. I'm not saying that there has not been a response at the international level by the UK government and other governments, the global north. But I personally, based on experience I have being a former practitioner, I have issues that could be fine-tuned for increasing the effectiveness of the international response, particularly when it comes to international aid. And how it should be delivered. I see some sort of space for improvement in those areas. For instance, in Afghanistan, I think for the past 20 years, there was a kind of model implemented that was sort of understood to be a one-size-fits-all model. But in my view, these are the things that could be contextualized in any international response to tackling the root causes of the migration crisis should take into consideration the local context and the power dynamics, the social norms, and everything that is affecting the effectiveness of the response.
Okay, thank you. So this is what people of my generation know as an intermission. So while you grab your Kia Aura and your vanilla ice cream, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter, because there you'll figure out everything we're doing and get yourself places to our exciting range of events. Subscribe now. Just listening to you both, I mean, you're both very focused on the sort of drivers of instability on the long term. I mean, this is going to sound like an awfully naive question, I think, but how do you look at the projections and the forecasts, whether it's about what's going to happen to climate and the ability to grow food in the global south, whether it's about population growth, and not just despair? Because every bit of data you see around what the future holds points to this being the tip of the iceberg, to the situation getting much, much worse going forward, and us seeing much greater movements of population if those projections about global warming prove to be correct, and if those projections about population prove to be correct. I mean, how does that not scare you?
The data is really alarming, and it's particularly alarming for our clients, for people who are in these, living in these incredibly fragile situations where they are going to have least ability to access support and resources out of, you know, anyone, anywhere in the world. So the data is alarming, but I think it is easy to get into this mindset where you think there's just this inevitable escalation of humanitarian needs as you look ahead. And I think what we would say is it's not inevitable. And you can point to examples like there was a six-month truce in Yemen last year for the first time in a long time. It didn't hold. But while that truce was in place, the number of civilian deaths fell sharply. The ports were open. There were flights coming back into the airport. There was food back on the shelves of shops, and people were able to start feeding themselves again. Yemen has had one of the highest malnutrition rates in the world. But things started to improve, and so you can look ahead with despair, or you can look ahead and you can see that there are alternatives. And we've been talking a lot about the humanitarian needs and the work that we do to meet those needs. But of course, the reasons those needs exist in the first place is because the systems around these people caught up in conflict and crisis are failing. And so what we spend a lot of time doing is not just meeting the needs, but also advocating for systematic, system-wide solutions to reducing these needs in the first place. So an example of that is the awful drought and conflict that we're seeing across East Africa, where we are worried about the risk of famine there. But what's needed is, yes, it's funding, and yes, it's that humanitarian response, but it's also diplomatic engagement that and in that example, there's something called the High Level Task Force on Famine Prevention, which was set up by the UN Secretary General. We're saying that needs to be revitalized, re-energized, and that the UK government and others can put diplomatic energy into getting that working again as a mechanism to detect these likely deteriorations of the situation, and to ensure that funding flows quickly and early where it's needed to stop the very worst happening. So there's a diplomatic solution there, and in all of the places where we work, there are diplomatic solutions and political solutions that can make a real difference. The choice that the UK government and others have to make is whether or not to expend the energy in driving those diplomatic solutions forward. But there are solutions if the energy is there to drive them forward.
Abdul, do you manage to remain as positive as Laura sounds?
Yes, I totally agree with you, and I think Laura has covered everything I was to say.
Okay, I mean, one interesting thing for me is that, you know, over the last few years, you've seen the politics of the West go in a certain direction that was, I mean, you might not say isolationist, but a slight sense of turning their backs on the world, whether it's to do with trade, whether it's to do with immigration, whatever it is, this slight increase that I detect of insularity amongst some of the prosperous Western countries. Do you get that sense as well, that you're in a way swimming against the tide, and it's even more of a struggle now to persuade Western leaders that they need to engage in some of these areas, if only for their own self-interest to prevent refugee flows ahead? Is that becoming a harder argument to win nowadays than it used to be?
What I would say on that is that yes, it can feel like there are very strong political headwinds that we are dealing with at the moment. But also things change very quickly. If you look at the United States now, my colleagues in the States were really battling a few years ago. If you look at now what's happening, President Biden has lifted the refugee resettlement numbers right back up to where they were in the Obama period. So the US is targeting 125,000 refugees that they will resettle again this year. Fantastic. If you look at Somalia, I mean, 80% of the funding that's coming into Somalia now comes from the United States government. So they've really stepped up in the United States. They've really stepped up internationally. And I think we in the UK, and for my colleagues elsewhere in Europe, where the headwinds feel stronger, we have to hope that there will be a similar change. And public opinion is always interesting on this. I think you can assume that you can make the mistake of assuming that political opinion and public opinion are aligned. But actually, what we've seen is quite an interesting polarization. So it's not necessarily that the public has turned against supporting refugees and spending money on overseas aid. It's just that a certain segment of the public has, but another segment really supports what we're doing. So we did some polling recently, actually, on what the public thought. It was with YouGov in January on what the public thought about integrating refugees in the UK. 2/3 were in favour of more integration support for refugees in the UK, looking specifically at English language provision and support for getting into employment. So the support is there among certain segments of the population, and that for us is really heartening and a sign that politics could follow.
I mean, just on that, I mean, we found in our work that since the referendum, public opinion on immigration, I mean, it's a slightly different thing, but on immigration has become far more liberal, or significantly more liberal, than it was in 2016. And this has been a bit of a secular trend from 2016. Is that something that impinges on your work, or something that you're aware of? Is it something that you've noticed in this country?
That's interesting. We've certainly noticed the outpouring of support for refugees from Ukraine. But as I say, there is that underlying wider support for refugees as well. We've also seen these incredible outpourings of support for the Disasters Emergency Committee appeals, 400 million they've raised for Ukraine. So there clearly is a large segment of the public that wants Britain to be engaged, wants to play their part as the public in engaging. Yes, we have certainly seen that. But we also do see the counter trend. We're very aware of the language, the dangerous at times language that is used on the other side of the debate to describe the people that we're here to serve. And that does worry me. That worries me in terms of the risks to our clients here in the UK. It worries me because the words that are used set the framework for the actions that are taken. So certain parts of some refugee charities in the UK have renamed this illegal migration bill the refugee ban bill. An illegal migration bill, if you call it that, sets you up for a very different course of action for, say, a refugee something else would do. So, the language matters and the language can be divisive, but there is also a base of support there. And I would be interested to hear from Abdul on this, because you're living here in the UK as a refugee.
Yes, I'll share my experience. I think yes, I have witnessed this as well. I'm one of the beneficiaries of the resettlement and the reintegration schemes falling under the Afghan citizens relocation scheme. And I think we were warmed welcome to the UK. I arrived like a year and a half ago here in the UK after spending like about 3 months in a quarantine hotel followed by a bridging hotel. I was provided with an accommodation with a house that was luckily near to my university where I was doing a master's degree at the time. In addition to that, the response in terms of resettlement and reintegration was quite comprehensive, covering from support from trainings and skills all the way to the mental health support and childcare support, as well as their education and health services. So it was quite a comprehensive response. Of course, there is always a room for discussions and debates and improvements. For instance, a key challenge that fellow Afghans and fellow migrants at the moment are facing is housing. I think it's a big issue that I remember that those people who traveled with me in the same plane, they're still staying in hotels and in a very, very bad conditions. So their trauma is even deepened by the fact that they're not able to get a house in the areas they would like to prefer to stay with their families. So there are, of course, challenges still that a more responsive response could tackle, but the response is quite timely and it's quite comprehensive.
That's really interesting, Abdul. Thank you. I mean, I get the sense in a way that what you're saying is when the system does work, it can work quite well. It's just that it doesn't always work that well. Would that be fair?
Yes, and that leaves a lot of beneficiaries and a lot of migrants out of the response, and it disappoints them in a way. I think as you rightly said, it does work, but it doesn't work for everyone. So maybe there are issues on the side of the refugees and migrants as well. For instance, all their needs and demands might not be realized, because I understand that the government, in the response system, they have limited resources. But I think it's also very important to think about the increase in terms of resources and the capacity to respond to the needs of these people. I'm in touch with so many families. They are still living in the hotels, and frankly speaking, they are suffering from anxiety and from stress, and this is in addition to the stress and the deep trauma they experience on the collapse of the state in Afghanistan in August 2021. So I believe that I'm sure that there is not a linear solution and there is no easy solution, but at least I think it would be very relevant to think about increase in terms of resources and when it comes to capacity and to response to the needs of these people.
Thank you. And I mean, for both of you, really, does the debate about the illegal migration bill frustrate you? Because it strikes me as quite a one-sided sort of debate in which actually, I mean, people talk about protecting migrants from the traffickers, but in terms of our international commitments to refugees, to letting them come here, to sort of giving them a fair hearing, does this debate sort of drive you mad? Technical question.
Do you want to answer, Abdul? Don't want to cut you
off. I think it's very hard to answer because the UK government, they have their own argument on why they've come up with introducing this bill. Based on what I'm hearing from the media, I think the UK government has done everything to tackle the issue, but they've acknowledged that they were not successful in doing them. And this was as a last resort. But what I really do not agree with, the way this bill is introduced and the way it is in a way sacrificing some of the real and genuine migrants who are in real support of protection in asylum seeking here in the UK, because it indiscriminately looking at everyone as someone who are not in need of support and someone who is not a genuine refugee. I think there are people who are really in need of protection. And in my view, if this bill will be implemented the way it has been introduced, it might further enslave and pave the ground for modern enslavement. Of course, there are some sort of like challenges. I understand that the UK government, because probably politics is an explanation to it. But I think this could be at least modified.
Anything to add, Laura?
Yeah. I mean, clearly, if you want to protect these people, there are far more compassionate and effective and probably cheaper ways of doing it. you're not going to deter people from coming unless there is a safe alternative way to come to the UK. And I think that's really, I mean, that's really come through in some of the recent debates on the bill. Unless you're from Ukraine or a very small number of people from Afghanistan, a very small number of people from Syria, or unless you're from Hong Kong, there is no safe way to come to the UK. And because of the type, you know, we've been talking about growing humanitarian crises around the world, people are going to keep fleeing their homes. They are a small number of them, and it is a small number, and we have to keep it in proportion, but a small number of them are going to keep coming and trying to get to the UK. So it won't stop people attempting these journeys unless there is a safe alternative. It's also so important that as one of the governments that in 1951 helped to craft and draft the Refugee Convention, that those commitments that we made at the time are upheld. And that includes a commitment to people's right to seek asylum. And, you know, God forbid Brits were ever found in a situation like the situation that people getting onto these small boats is in, I think we would hope that that right to seek asylum was also upheld. So the right to seek asylum must be upheld. And if you want to do that, there are ways of doing that, such as investing in the asylum system here in the UK, making sure that claims are heard fairly, but that they're also heard quickly, that decisions are then made quickly, and that people who claim asylum here are given their answer and able to get on with their lives, whether that's here in the UK or elsewhere, if their claims aren't successful. But there would be a way of investing in the asylum system here in the UK and coupling that with the introduction of more safe routes, which I think would give the government that sense of control of their borders again, which they so clearly want.
But would you accept the argument that there is an issue with numbers that the government makes, that, yeah, with the best will in the world, we want to sort of, you know, uphold the agreements we've signed up to, including the convention, but there have to be limits and we have to find a way of limiting. I mean, that seems to be one of the key points. But would you accept the premise of that argument?
I do think you have to put the numbers in context. So it was, I think, 72,000 people that claimed asylum in the UK in 2022. That compares to 130,000 in France. It compares to 244,000, I think, in Germany. So three times as many people essentially claimed asylum in Germany as they did in the UK last year. So in that global perspective, the numbers that do try to come to the UK are relatively small. But of course, I mean, it's a political choice that the government can make about how many people it wants to take into this country or not. And it's not for us as an NGO to say how to do that. But what we do feel is a very strong responsibility to our clients to ensure that they are they have the means to seek safety if they need that, and that they are protected in doing so.
Okay. Well, listen, Laura and Abdul, I just want to thank you for the insights you've given us into the work that you do. It's been really, really fascinating to listen to you both, and good luck with your work going forward. And thank you both so, so much for taking the time to talk to me. It's been great.
Thanks very much for having us.
Thank you very much.